everyone. Welcome to our podcast today of Energy in Action, sponsored by Mito Action. This is Stephanie. I'm here today with two professors from the Department of Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Washington in Seattle. I have Mark and Dagmar here, and they are working with us on a project to go ahead and collect some data and information about a community within the Mito community, and that's of folks who are diagnosed with a TK2 deficiency. And without saying more about that and confusing everyone, I'm going to let the experts go ahead and take care of it. If one of you would like to go ahead and start and give us a little background on your history in finding out natural history studies on different patient groups and how you became linked with Zogenics and how you're working to try and help our community, that would be very helpful.
Sure. Maybe I'll start. This is Mark talking. My research, I'm a clinical psychologist by training in rehabilitation medicine, and my research has really focused mostly on chronic pain, understanding pain, its impact on people's lives, how best to treat it, and to understand the mechanisms of different treatments. So I've been doing work in this area for decades now, and maybe 20 years ago, I started working with two colleagues in the pain space, and that's Arnold Gamatoni and Bradley Gaylor. And together, we developed some measures of pain, and we were studying pain and pain treatments, and I loved working with them. Eventually, they went on to work with Zogenics, which is a company that doesn't focus on pain, but they contacted me maybe 4 years ago and told me they were interested in working with me to develop some measures of the effects of severe epilepsy on the lives and the quality of life of caregivers, because they're working in the space of treatment of severe epilepsy. And I jumped at the opportunity to work with them again. They're delightful to work with. So even though it wasn't in my area of specialty, pain, it was in one area of specialty and interest, which is the development of measures. And I then recruited another colleague that I've been working with here at the University of Washington, Dagmar Amptman, because she's an expert in measure development. And so together, the group of us developed this new measure of caregiver burden. And it involved starting from the ground up. And although the purpose was to start with caregiver burden, when we spoke to the parents of the children with severe epilepsy, they also told us that there were benefits of being a caregiver.
Really?
And so we responded to the community and developed together with the support from Zogenics, a new measure of caregiver burden and benefits. And wow. That was very, very successful of research. We now have measures that have been translated. We're continuing to work in those. But Zogenics is also very interested in studying TK2 deficiency. And because of our successful collaboration, they invited us to work with them to do a study to understand the effects of having a diagnosis of 2K2D in the lives of people with this diagnosis. And so that's the study that we're just starting now, and we're terribly excited about.
Definitely. We're excited too, because as I stated earlier, this is a group in our community that doesn't have the same notoriety, if you will, with the Lays and the Malas and the MRF patients who have a lot of research behind them already. And I think it's wonderful that we're seeing that tie-in that Zogenics has found with epilepsy and how this is affecting, how this deficiency is affecting our patient group. One thing I did learn in my research was that this deficiency can be found almost anywhere in somebody's lifespan. It's not something that's identified on newborn screening. It can be identified early in life, but there are some young adults who have struggled a lot of their life, and then have had some sort of episode where the findings have come through. So knowing that you have this wide variety of people, your study is really looking at 17 and under or 18 and under? Or are you looking at everybody in the population?
Everybody in the population, regardless of their age, regardless of the onset, whether, you know, doesn't matter. As long as you have been diagnosed with the condition, you can participate in our study.
Okay. So I'm curious about working in the development of measure. So how do you adequately find, or do you need to adequately find enough people in each group of diagnosis, or are we just putting everybody into one funnel and seeing how the information comes through?
Yeah, so I'll take that.
Okay.
So I just want to add on to our previous discussion about developing measures for parents, caregivers of children with severe epilepsy. The two measures that we developed are now being used in clinics to identify parents who need help, who are stressed and need additional supports. That's one use of it. The other use of it is that researchers now can study effects of treatments because they have a way to measure it. So we're hoping to get to the same place with people with TK2D. So little is known about how it affects people's quality of life that it's really difficult to assess whether what we're doing is actually working for people, whether it's making their lives better. And so the purpose for this study, as a first step towards that, is to catalog, to observe, to describe what is affected, like what parts of people's lives are affected by this disorder, and then describe it for researchers so that we can better understand how to treat and identify people with the disorder. With so few people, I think there is less than 200 people in the world with this disorder. So with so few people, we just try to approach and identify anybody that is willing to talk to us and use the information they provide us to describe how their lives are changed and affected by this disorder. Then we normally develop questions and then ask those questions of as many people as possible. In this case, it will be a small sample. We're hoping to get to maybe be able to talk to about 40 people. Normally, we try to get to 500, sometimes even more people to gather all the information. So we're hoping that we can get at least 40 people who will help us describe the effects of TK2D on their lives. And it will be people of all ages. We are talking to children who are 8 or older. We're talking to children themselves. If they are under 4, so if they're between 8 and 14, we talk to the child and their parent. If they're less than 8 years old, then we talk to their parents. If they are over 14, we interview themselves. So we're trying to map all the areas in which TK2D changes people's lives and get some idea about magnitude of those changes and describe the effects of the condition as a first step towards developing the measures.
Wow. So this really is, in my mind, pre-clinical trial data where you are really just educating yourselves and researchers on how this is affecting our patient population, basically at a granular level, their day-to-days, education opportunities, how this has affected everything from education to vocation. And it's strictly patient-based at this point, right?
Correct, yes.
Okay, as best recorded when you're working with parents speaking for the younger groups, which correct. Obviously you have to do that. So, wow, that just seems like such an undertaking. And will the two of you be doing the interviewing?
We, the two of us, and we have research staff. So depending on who is available and, you know, how far in the study we are. So far, I have done two interviews. And as we recruit more people, we'll be doing more interviews. The added complexity here is that there are only, I think, 5 people in the US with this condition. So most people are elsewhere and may not speak English. So we have a collaborator who is a native Spanish speaker. There seem to be the most people with TK2D seem to be living in Spain. So we have recruited and trained her to conduct interviews in Spanish. So depending on the circumstances, and the language, that will determine who will actually speak with the person.
So this begs my curious question here. This is just strictly conversational. Do you think there's more identified in Spain because they've been identified in Spain and not elsewhere? Or why is there a larger population in Spain?
I don't know the answer to that. Do you, Mark?
I don't. It could be certainly that Spain is just better organized and has clinics in place to identify people. It wouldn't surprise me that if the rate is the same all over the world, but there are people in different countries who are simply not yet diagnosed. They don't know what's wrong with them, and the care providers aren't educated enough to look for the signs. And so we think this is one of the potential benefits of this study, because we will publish the findings and we will get the word out about this condition, about the factors and their life factors that are most impacted. And maybe as we educate people in other countries, they will then start to identify it more. Alternatively, it is also possible that there is something about certain areas of the world where it's just more likely to occur. And that's an unanswered question. So Stephanie, you're clearly a researcher at heart. You've gotten right to the heart of some critical research questions, but that we hope that our study will help to get people curious enough to start to look at these questions. That's really one of the goals of the study, is just to get information out there about this, to get researchers interested to ask these kinds of questions.
I definitely think this would be, because there are so many head scratchers within our population. And as we're finding, I've been in the mitochondrial disease world since 1999, and the growth that I've seen in 21 years is amazing. But there are still so many times where we're hearing, you know, I don't know, maybe this is a secondary condition too. Maybe your child or your spouse's condition is a primary, and we're looking at something else that's driving the primary. But nobody knows where to start looking. I know there's this misconception that a lot of people think when they have a gene study done that their sample is put into some Wizard of Oz computer and it spits out all the right answers, from, you know, will I have hair loss to what my genetic code tells you. And that's just not how it works. And so I think providing research that says, if you have a patient presenting with, and then lay out what this with looks like, they're able to say, let's look for this, or let's look for these deficiencies. And we're finding more and more deficiencies now that we have whole exome studies going on and finding out just how important these protein connections are and, links now between, now like mitochondrial disease has always been a genetic cousin to the muscular dystrophy world. And now we're wondering and potentially making connections that some of the mitochondrial disease kids are also linking off to what's called the FAOD kids. And it's like, so how are all of these things now that we're finding research, there always has to be some common path, right? We don't just have all these splinters, something has to start bringing it together. And I know that a lot of the families I work with have kids with mitochondrial disease as like an umbrella, but they have these seizures disorders. They have these all kinds of things. When I read what TK2 deficiency looks like, I think, has anybody asked you about this? Have you looked into this? And from Canada to Brazil in my last week of talking with patients just in, North America and South America, people are like, no, we've never heard of this. And so just Zogenix and YouTube bringing this to me has given me more questions to ask people and to ask their physicians, hey, is this something, we should be looking at, or do we fall into this criteria? So I've already been enlightened. And I hate to say this, but this isn't even one of the harder mitochondrial diseases to understand. So yeah. I'm really excited that this information could get out there and you could put a box around it and say, this is what we're reporting. This is how our families started out on this journey. This is what was happening prior to their diagnosis or what led to their diagnosis. And this is what's happening since they've been diagnosed, because there isn't any treatment. We just play affectionately whack-a-mole for people with mitochondrial disease. There's absolutely no effective treatment for any one of them, even though we're starting to categorize and collect and research. So we work with dealing with the symptoms and all of the other outcrops that come with it. So I think I'm thrilled that you're coming in and looking at a specific silo of it and saying, here's what it is. And if we can stop or work with families who have children or patients with epileptic seizures, what else does that help? If you can control that, how does that spread out into helping other things?
Yeah, you raise a really good point, Stephanie, that even when you focus on just one condition, the information you gain is useful to other related conditions because they are often connected. And just for example, the measures that we developed to look at caregiver burden in individuals who take care of a child with severe epilepsy, that measure can be useful to understand the burden of caregiving for a child with any health condition. So even if you start with focusing on one, it can really advance understanding for others and can spark new ideas and new knowledge. So
what was something in that research that you found that was not really like a, wow, I never would have thought of that, but has become, or if you know, like where many doctors or physicians have said, if we had identified this within our caregivers, we would have had more compliant patient medication. We would have had, there's so many reasons where patients are considered non-compliant. And in one of the areas, it's in patient medication dosing. Whether it's life gets busy, there's all kinds of reasons why people don't take their medication as prescribed. But if anything has taught us from the Parkinson's world and all of the study in Parkinson's, is taking your medication on time as prescribed makes everything go smoother. And we have a couple of researchers now in the MITO world who are willing to work with the patient group and saying, you're right, four times a day is tricky. How can you caregivers, what can we do for you caregivers? If we get this medication down to two times a day, what does that do for you? And that makes all of us sit back and go, well, as a caregiver, that frees up about 16 hours of my day of managing all kinds of things to make sure at that exact time we get medication in. So that was a big aha moment for our group, was just finding that, you know, if you want to call it compliance or adherence or whatever it is. And it also freed up caregivers, or taught us informally, to say, I can tell you right now, we will not be compliant if you order in this medication to be taken at 7 p.m. when we have meds going at 5, 8, and 9. So if you can figure this out to not be in the middle, we can do it successfully. And that also then opened up a doorway for many caregivers to work with their team to have conversations and be more of a professional patient instead of just sitting back, taking on, quote, more burden, and then going home and trying to manage it. And I think I am constantly working with families on, you have to advocate not only for your child, but as a caregiver, you have to say, that's not doable for our schedule. And it's not because you're trying to be difficult, it's because you are in the trenches and you know when to raise the white flag, or if you don't, I'm gonna teach you when. But you have to, because otherwise it's just futile, right? You can have all of the tools put in front of you, but if you don't know how to use them, or you don't admit, I can't do this, there's no point in having them.
Yeah.
So I think the information you found in that caregiver study has most likely trickled over into other things, because this is all within probably the last 18 months that we've had this aha moment in our medical community, which I am grateful for.
Yeah, I have a couple of thoughts. One is that one of the big surprises from this study was that, you know, we went in with the goal of wanting to develop a measure of caregiver burden. But we wanted to do it from the ground up and hear from the individuals what's important to you. Well, what we learned was that, in fact, there are benefits as well. And one of the benefits that people told us was that I'm able to become a better advocate for my child. And so that, and this critical role of advocacy really seems to be very, very important. So now we have a measure of that as well, but we're told that because we're interacting, taking it from the caregivers and individuals themselves. So this partnership that you describe is so critical to good care. And it's a two-sided thing. So the individuals who have the condition or are taking care of somebody, it's useful when they learn skills to be able to advocate and communicate. It's also critical that we get the word out to caregivers to practitioners, healthcare providers, that they be open to working with and listening to the families that they work with. And that when that communication is there, care it can be so much better. And so part of our research program is just getting the word out about these ideas. And we're finding great interest in both the families that read about our study as research, as well as from caregivers or healthcare providers to understand what's going on. So these are key ideas that I think this area of research can really, really help facilitate.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dagmar.
If I may add to what Mark said, my biggest, aha moment from the work we've done with caregivers of kids with epilepsy was how much stress there is on these parents and how little support we provide in the US as a society. But really was, so we would have these focus groups of 5, 6, 7 parents of kids with severe epilepsy. And I was so grateful that Mark was there because he's a clinical psychologist. We've never gotten through any of those without somebody crying, breaking down and crying. It is so difficult for these families. The effect is not just on the child with epilepsy, it's on the whole family unit. There was one mom who said, "Wow, nobody has ever asked me how I am doing. Everybody just asks about the kid." And so I felt that was a great service that we brought to light, that, you know, what the effect is on the whole family unit, mm-hmm. and how important it is to provide support to caregivers. And if you support caregivers, the care for the person with the condition is automatically going to be better. And the effects on the siblings, on the relationship of the parents, and so on, gets much improved if you pay attention to and support caregivers.
What we hear in our support group when we offer support calls on a weekly basis is, you know, that whole thing of, well, you caregivers need to put your oxygen mask on first. And we laugh and say, but we don't even know where that is. Help me find the oxygen mask. And that's all we want, is just give me that support. Even if that support is just, for me, it was just somebody honestly taking me by the shoulders and saying, you are doing a good job. And one day of hearing that was like, oh, thank you for recognizing I'm doing everything I can right now. And we have tears all the time on people saying, I've never been heard. And our patients say the same thing, because they feel that their story isn't important enough, or that nobody truly believes what their symptoms are or how their life has changed since diagnosis. And I think it's really important that you're taking this information and gathering it and presenting it back out to the clinical world and saying, here's a synopsis of this patient group. This is how this has affected them. Now it's up to you, research world, to take this information and figure out how to rectify it or utilize it to find a way to ease this, or use it, find a way to look at this and say, oh, well, you know, this could be caused by, you know, look at all of these symptoms. And, you know, I've always been the proponent. I live in Minnesota. 3M has made all kinds of wonderful products, and I'm convinced most of them have been made by accident, including Post-it notes. And I don't care how they find treatment for my son. If it comes through Parkinson's, if it comes through Alzheimer's, I don't care. But just find it. I really don't care anymore. Just somebody find some help. And I'm thankful that you are able to take your backgrounds and put I keep using this phrase, but put the box around it, because right now I feel like a whole, like these disease groups, especially ours, is just Legos all over the floor, and somebody needs to get us all scooped together, put back in the box, and then systematically put us together how we need to be and presented back out. So
I interviewed one about 50-year-old woman with TK2D, and it took decades for her to be diagnosed. Decades. She told me literally, I was never normal. She said in high school, she was on a swim team, but she was the slowest person on that swim team. She says, I never could do what other kids could do. Yet it took until she lost her ability to speak for them to look into genetic testing and see if that could explain what's happening to her. So I think just describing what it looked like when, you know, what people's lives were like mm-hmm. describing their stories, we're hoping will help people get diagnosed sooner and better understand what to look for.
Right. And that's key because, again, we have so many, even in just our world, even though we're already under the umbrella, where there's a lot of head scratching and I don't know, you know, these symptoms have gone on his whole life. I don't know. Well, maybe, you know, more and more of these types of studies happening where we're asking all the questions and hearing. I know, I mean, this sounds, I hate to say it because it sounds so weird, but I have found my tribe, my blanket fort of people in social media, because I have found a whole group of parents who have children. And I say whole group, I mean seven, who have children who look like my son, who gets a vaccine and within 30 days, their body eliminates it. Well, in today's world of topics, everybody says the word vaccine all day long. And we're all trying, the seven of us are trying to figure out, do we vaccinate them or don't we? What will happen with this type of vaccine? They've never had this type of vaccine. And it was so relieving to find out, A, at the NIH, why my son, you know, that he had this, you know, how do you get vaccinated for something and still have the disease? And then all of a sudden find seven more families that say, well, we have that same thing. And to be able to have those commonalities. But so now it was like, if you guys would take the seven of us and put us together and find all of our commonalities and put them out professionally, I'm sure there's research people out there who would be like, oh, that's some interesting information when it's put together professionally, besides parents just babbling away on social media. But that's how we find each other nowadays. That's how we find each other. Wow. So after this study is done, what do you see on your horizon next? Do you see us, do you see yourself still working with Sogenics and diving in deeper with their research?
Well, we certainly hope so. We do really enjoy working with them and they're, you know, wanting to help the community. So the next steps, we'd have to sort of wait and see what emerges from this study to see what the next steps are. But some a reasonable next step could be a development of a measure that measures quality of life in people with TK2D or with mito conditions in general. And so you can develop then profiles to help distinguish what are the commonalities, what are different. We could see the development of measures that would look at outcomes. So we could see, you know, not only how a treatment benefits a primary outcome like seizure frequency or weakness, but other quality of life outcomes as well. So how does this affect the whole person, their whole life? So we take things one step at a time, and each step of research, what the next step you take depends in large part on what you've learned in the first step. So it's hard to say exactly where will it go, but I'm a big believer in increasing our scientific knowledge. So this is a critical first step.
I agree. And
if I may add to that wish list, I hope we could take it to include adult caregivers, the caregivers of adults. So the measures we developed before are for caregivers of children, people under 18. But now as I'm talking to people with TK2D, their spouses or, you know, other people in their lives have to do everything for them, talk for them, take care of their everyday needs, help them eat, help them with everything, all basic daily activities. And the impact on those caregivers is huge. So this is really far down the road, but I think we shouldn't forget the caregivers and include them in our work and assess their lives and perhaps help identify caregivers who need additional supports.
I completely agree with that because I've had numerous spouses say to me, I signed up to be their spouse and I'm not a very good nurse. And those are not synonymous with each other.
Absolutely.
And there's no fault in that, but it's just not synonymous. And we remind people that it's okay to find somebody else. If that's not your thing, don't make it be your thing, because then you become resentful. So how do our patients that we find, where do we direct them to get involved in this study and to become? My goal now is to find you more than 5 people in the U.S.
Yes, so in the U.S., people can contact us by phone. We have a toll-free number. It's 844-847-7892. We okay. also have a local number in Seattle. I don't know if that's useful. We have an email, which anybody can email us from anywhere in the world. And the email is easy. It's tk2d@uw.edu.
Oh, that's very easy.
Yeah, and we're working on getting an international phone number so that people could call us toll-free from everywhere. And it's more complicated than it should be in today's world, but we'll get there. And so as soon as we get that number, we can provide it to you. Perhaps you could put it on your podcast website.
We definitely will, because Mito Action works with IMP, which is the International Mitochondrial Disease Group. And that's why I get the pleasure of talking. I have interacted with somebody on every continent now except Antarctica. So I find that really fulfilling and also really sad to find out that we just have people reaching out from everywhere looking for help and resources. And that, and when I speak to people, it's not just patients, it's caregivers, it's other professionals wanting to connect and say, I have a patient I can't figure out, who you have someone I can connect with. So I will definitely be giving out this information as fast and furious as I can. And I thank you to both for putting this together. I think I might want to change careers and get my undergrad now in development of measures. That sounds like something I would really appreciate doing, because I want to quantify everything. So thank you guys so much for being on our podcast. And I look forward to learning and hearing how your research comes and partnering with Zogenics more on this. So good luck to you.
Thank you very much. We'll report back.
Great. Yes. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye-bye.
I would like to thank Professors Mark Jensen and Dagmar Atman from the Department of Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Washington for having this great discussion with me about the importance of the development of measurement. It's great to learn how all of these decisions and clinical trials are put together so that we can have the most successful outcomes for the much needed medication. Thank you, everyone, for tuning into this week's episode of Energy in Action. Remember to give us a 5-star rating on your listening app to help boost us up the charts. This show was brought to you by Mito Action, Zogenics, and Ultragenics. Be sure to join next week for more All Things Mito. This is your host, Stephanie, Rare Mom Extraordinaire.